Chapter 16. Colonel Gaddafi's Libya. For Billy Waugh, the years spent working for the U.S. Postal Service from 1972 to 1977 were misery incarnate. Then came the mysterious call on July 20th, propelling him back into the world of covert action operations. "The location is overseas," the caller said. "Fine by me," said Waugh. If Waugh was in, the man on the phone said he'd arrange for a down payment to be wired into his bank account. "I'm in," said Waugh. More details would be forthcoming, but in the meantime, Waugh needed to travel to Northern Virginia and check into a specific hotel at 3 p.m. on July 25th, just a few days away. Waugh agreed to the meeting at the hotel. 48 hours later, a large sum of money appeared in Waugh's bank account. The down payment was twice as much as the post office paid in a year. The overseas job was guaranteed for 6 months, but might continue for years, he was told. All travel and living expenses would be paid by the client, whose identity was to remain hidden for now. "Bring clothes to last for a year in a very warm climate," the man said. "The location is Africa." Waugh considered the situation. "My instinct and intuition told me this was a CIA operation," he recalls, "that the agency was forming some kind of a ground team for a covert operation in Africa. I figured this was how the CIA worked, now that covert action operations had been curtailed." The next day at the post office, Waugh told his supervisor that he was resigning his position. "You're a good worker, and the post office is a good job," Waugh recalls the man saying. "Why are you leaving?" Waugh said he wasn't cut out for post office work. At home, he packed a small bag. On the assigned day, he flew to Washington, D.C., and took a cab to the hotel in Northern Virginia. At the 3 p.m. meeting, he was not surprised to see the faces of three Green Berets from SOG, soldiers he'd worked with during the Vietnam War. Based on the skill set of the team members, it was clear to Waugh that the job was paramilitary in nature. The four-man team included a medic, a communications man, a handheld weapons instructor, and Waugh, an expert in intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and heavy weapons. During the meeting, a fifth man showed up and identified himself as the client's lawyer. The team would be traveling to Libya, the lawyer said. Their job was to train soldiers who were part of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's elite special forces. In addition to being its president, Gaddafi served as the country's commander-in-chief. The former SOG operators were escorted to the Libyan embassy and issued travel visas. "We were told our flight was leaving late the next day," remembers Waugh. Back at his hotel room, Waugh considered the facts and his suppositions. In order to ensure plausible deniability, he guessed, the CIA was using paramilitary contractors and hiring them in a roundabout way. The situation presented an excellent financial opportunity for him. Still, his intuition said, make a few calls. Waugh reached out to several CIA contacts he had in Washington. None of the people he spoke with had any knowledge of this Libyan operation. He called the client's lawyer and asked if the mission was a covert operation for the CIA. The lawyer said it was not. "He assured me it was all above board and there was no legal risk," Waugh says, "that we were going to be training the Libyan special forces in basic infantry tactics only." Waugh asked to know the name of the client. The lawyer said the man's name was Edwin P. Wilson, and that he was a former CIA officer. The client's lawyer said that while en route to Africa, the team would stop in Geneva for a briefing. There, they'd meet Edwin Wilson himself, who'd pay them directly and give them the names of their contacts inside the Libyan military. It was a sensitive job, the lawyer said, which is why the money was so good. Not everyone in Libya was pro-American, so it was imperative that the operators keep their identities hidden, for example, by always wearing a balaclava, the lawyer said, whenever they were on a military base. Colonel Gaddafi's friends included Fidel Castro and Idi Amin, the president of Uganda. Gaddafi didn't want anyone to know he also had American friends, the lawyer explained. Waugh hung up and considered the situation. While he was sitting there thinking about what all this meant, the telephone rang. The caller addressed Waugh by name. Waugh didn't recognize the man's voice, nor did the caller identify himself. Instead, he told Waugh that the two of them had mutual friends, and he mentioned two names, both of whom Waugh recognized as CIA. The man asked Waugh to meet him at a restaurant in Arlington, Virginia, in an hour. It was important, the man said. Waugh should come right away. The meeting is about your upcoming travel plans to Africa, the caller said cryptically. At the restaurant, the man showed Billy Waugh his credentials, which identified him as working for the CIA. He said that his name was Pat. About the upcoming trip to Libya, it's not an agency operation, Pat said. Pat pulled out a briefcase and set it on the table between them. He opened up the case and removed a Pentax 35mm camera and several rolls of black and white film. He slid everything across the table to Billy Waugh. Pat said that I could assist the agency and myself by taking photographs of the various military facilities I'd be visiting in Libya, Waugh recalls. Of particular interest to Pat was an area 45 miles inland from the Gulf of Sidra called Jebel Akhtar, the Green Mountain, where there was a classified Libyan military facility. Satellite images indicated that surface-to-air missile sites were set up there, Pat explained, protecting the airspace around Benghazi. The missiles were Russian. Pat said that the CIA wanted photographs of them. Waugh considered what he was being told. There was a loophole in the U.S. Neutrality Act. While it was illegal to enlist in a foreign army, it was not illegal to advise a foreign army. That said, training a terrorist organization in explosives and munitions was treason. Libya was not yet a designated state sponsor of terrorism, but only because the State Department had not yet created its official list. However, Muammar Gaddafi was under the watchful eye of the CIA. To understand Gaddafi's actions, the CIA relied on open-source intelligence and some human intelligence, mostly from Arab locals, whose trustworthiness was anybody's guess. The CIA wanted Billy Waugh to act as its eyes and ears on the ground, Pat told Waugh. In training Gaddafi's commandos, he'd be part of Gaddafi's inner circle. The risks were great, but the rewards could be huge. Pat slid a small piece of paper across the table. On the paper was written a telephone number. This was to be Waugh's contact, Pat said. He gave Waugh a phrase and reply code, tradecraft for CIA assets in the field, and said Waugh should use both elements of the code in the event a problem arose in Libya. Waugh was told not to mention this assignment to anyone, not to his team members in Libya, and not to the man financing the operation, Edwin P. Wilson. Finally, Pat said, if the photographs were decent, Waugh would be compensated for his efforts. Pat asked Waugh if he understood the request and if he accepted the assignment. Waugh said yes. Waugh was going to Libya to work for an American entrepreneur who was doing business with Gaddafi. No one outside Waugh's agency contacts could know that he was also working for the CIA. As Waugh headed to Benghazi in August of 1977, Libya inhabited a peculiar spot in the geopolitical landscape. For those living in Libya, life had already become a living hell. But on the international stage, the country was still considered a tinderbox waiting to catch fire. CIA analysts watched Gaddafi's every move, and its Libyan desk hummed with timely reports. Soon, they would include Libyan military secrets passed on from Biliwah. Muammar Gaddafi had seized power in a military coup 8 years before, in 1969, overthrowing the monarchy of King Idris. Gaddafi, then a military captain, made himself a colonel and declared his political party, the Revolutionary Command Council, to be the highest authority in Libya. He immediately imprisoned those who'd served the previous administration, many of whom would never be seen or heard from again. He tried King Idris in absentia and sentenced him to death. Much as Che Guevara and Fidel Castro had promised for Latin America, unity and harmony among a group of people who live in a certain region, so Gaddafi promised a beneficent solidarity for all Arab nations. Like his idol, Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser, Gaddafi espoused a pan-Arab nationalism, the revolutionary brand. Within a year of assuming power, Gaddafi expelled from the country all American and British military advisors and shut down their military facilities, calling them bases of imperialism. The Italians, Libya's former colonizers, fared worse. 12,000 Italians were banished, told to exhume the bones of their dead relatives and take them back to Italy. The event was televised on Libyan state TV. Gaddafi promised reform for the people, including the nationalization of state oil. To promote a pan-Libyan identity, Gaddafi created something called the Arab Socialist Union, which fizzled. After the death of Nasser in September 1970, Gaddafi tried to assume the position of Arab unifier, but that endeavor also failed. He then worked to create an Arab federation with Egypt, Syria, and Sudan. They all received sizable financial grants thanks to the vast wealth Libya enjoyed through its oil, and had no choice but to go along. But this, too, failed. When, in 1973, Gaddafi learned of a coup being plotted against him, his grip tightened. He created a militia to protect the revolution and began a systematic purge of the educated class. Death squads terrorized the population. Political parties were outlawed. Under the draconian Law 75, dissent became illegal. The state took control of the press. There were no legal codes or a legal system. Justice was arbitrary. Constitutional law was suspended and replaced with Sharia, Islamic law. For his first few years in power, Gaddafi was vocal in his disdain for the two superpowers, the United States and Russia, referring to each as a plague. They were together engaged in a conspiracy to harm the Third World, Gaddafi said. Privately, he bought MiG fighter jets, anti-aircraft guns, and heavy weapon systems from the Soviet Union. Libya's neighbors, most notably Egypt and Sudan, grew suspicious and then alarmed. Gaddafi was no reformer. He was a megalomaniacal despot. Then, Egypt's new president, Anwar Sadat, began making inroads toward an alliance with the United States. A turning point in public perception came in 1977 when Fidel Castro arrived in Libya for a 10-day visit as a guest of Gaddafi. "We are all revolutionaries," Castro told the Libyan Congress. "The revolution must continue." To a standing ovation, Castro praised Gaddafi. Comrade al-Qaddafi has struggled for the sake of unity of the Arab world like no one else has done, Castro said. His struggle for prosperity, man's dignity, freedom against exploitation bind us together. We highly admire what you are doing. Castro insisted that the greedy imperialists needed to be fought to death by any means necessary. There was only one way, one path. He ended his speech with a call to arms against the United States. The country of death. It was into this incendiary climate that Billy Waugh landed in Tripoli, Pentax camera in hand, a covert action operator for the CIA. At the airport in Tripoli, Waugh and the others were met by a man who went by the name Mohammed Fatah, likely an alias. The team was escorted through Libyan customs, then to a hotel on the beach. In the morning, they met with Qaddafi's Minister of Intelligence, Major Abdullah Hajazi. He spoke in Arabic, which Billy Waugh was able to understand, with some help from an interpreter. Back in 1956, during U.S. Army Special Forces training, he'd been sent to Monterey for a 5-month course in Arabic. He was rusty now, but soon he'd be almost fluent. The team split up into their areas of expertise. Waugh was taken to Benghazi, roughly 600 miles to the east on the coast. It did not take long for Waugh to figure out that Edwin P. Wilson had several teams of former Green Berets inside Libya doing an assortment of jobs. All were related to weapons training. Wilson, said to be a close personal friend of Qaddafi, owned a seaside villa on the north shore of Libya near Tripoli and ran his operations from there. In Benghazi, Billy Waugh was set up in a room at the Omar Khayyam Hotel under the watchful eye of Libyan handlers. Each day, a woman in a black abaya sat in the hallway outside his room taking notes. The only thing visible was her eyes, remembers Waugh. She was so hidden by a black robe, she could have been a man. Who knows? For several months at a time, Waugh trained Libyan commandos in small arms, heavy weapons, and explosives. How to ambush a target, conduct hit-and-run operations, sabotage. Most of the soldiers were unqualified and lazy, he recalls. Many of them were Qaddafi's friends or people he owed a favor. Most of them ignored training or flat out refused to be told what to do. Sometimes the consequences were lethal. Qaddafi wanted his own version of the U.S. Navy SEALs and assigned Waugh to lead training. During a training exercise on the Gulf of Sidra, one of the commandos in a boat ahead of Waugh leapt out of the boat into the water and drowned. He didn't know how to swim, recalls Waugh. He thought the scuba suit worked like a life preserver and would keep him afloat. In a post-accident debriefing, Waugh learned only 2 of the 22 commandos knew how to swim. Things were heating up across the Middle East and North Africa, with Colonel Qaddafi playing the role of central provocateur. In the summer of 1977, Qaddafi's forces carried out a tank raid on the Egyptian border town Saloum. In response, Anwar Sadat sent 3 Egyptian army divisions to its border with Libya, overpowering the Libyan brigades and pushing them back. The Egyptian Air Force attacked Libya's Gamal Abdel al-Nasser Air Base near the border. State Department officials feared Qaddafi wanted to provoke a war with Egypt. LARG, Libyan Arab Republic government, anticipates military attack from Egypt, which it hopes to exploit and cause overthrow of Sadat. Robert Carl, the U.S. Embassy Charge d'Affaires in Libya, wrote in a classified cable. The U.S. urged restraint and the border war lasted just 3 days. But the feud between Gaddafi and Sadat would not dissipate. The CIA had intelligence indicating that Gaddafi was plotting to have Sadat assassinated. In November 1977, the Pentagon provided Sadat with an armored helicopter, a Sikorsky CH-53E. The White House sent a U.S. Secret Service team to Cairo. They taught evasive driving techniques to Sadat's bodyguards. The CIA set up a secure communication system in the palace so that the president's moves could be anticipated. Anwar Sadat was America's best hope for an Arab partner in the Middle East, and he needed to stay alive. In November 1977, Sadat stunned the world by announcing his intention to visit Jerusalem and speak before the Knesset, Israel's national legislature. For the first time in three decades, an Arab nation was acknowledging the nation-state of Israel. Sadat's groundbreaking three-day visit to the country was a first step in what would become the Camp David Accords, but the move infuriated Arab leaders. Gaddafi called for Sadat's death. No one was more outraged than an Islamic extremist group inside Egypt called the Muslim Brotherhood. They, too, began plotting to assassinate President Anwar Sadat. It was in this extraordinarily volatile environment that Billy Wah operated over the next 2 years, reporting to Gaddafi's Minister of Intelligence, Major Abdullah Hajazi, and developing a close working relationship with a Libyan Special Forces captain who went by the name Mohammed Al-Faraj bin Agabay. Taking photographs without drawing suspicion was difficult at first, but over time, Wah became a trusted presence. I discovered that the commandos loved having their picture taken, and I took advantage of this, he says. He began taking photographs of extremely sensitive military sites. Flying in a helicopter to the military facility at the Green Mountain, he photographed surface-to-air missile sites set up in a ring around Benghazi. The CIA had long suspected that Gaddafi was getting these defense missile systems from the Soviet Union. Wah's photographs provided proof. As one of the favored trainers of Gaddafi's special forces, Wah was now the highest-placed CIA paramilitary asset in Libya, with direct access to Gaddafi's most sensitive military facilities. On one occasion, he was invited to attend a small air power demonstration with Gaddafi and a guest of honor, Idi Amin. During the event, Wah photographed Russian airplanes that the Soviets were supplying to Libya. Every action now had a dual purpose. While training Gaddafi's commandos how to halo jump out of aircraft over the desert, Wah mapped regions previously uncharted by U.S. intelligence agencies. The information that Wah provided to his CIA handler was sensitive, as well as dangerous to his own livelihood, always marked TSSCI, top secret, secret compartmented information, no form, no foreigners, no contract, no contractors, or con, original source controlled, to keep Wah as a source compartmentalized. What Billy Wah did not know at the time was that, in addition to gathering intelligence for the CIA on Gaddafi, he was also gathering intelligence for the CIA on Edwin P. Wilson. The U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ, and the CIA were building a case against Wilson, who the DOJ believed was illegally selling heavy weapons and high-powered explosives to Libya. Every few months, Wah would travel back to Washington, D.C., file reports, turn in his film, then return to Libya with his Pentax camera and a new supply of 35mm film. In the spring of 1979, he arrived in Benghazi and received unusual news. His Libyan counterpart, Mohammed Al-Faraj bin Agabeh said they were going to drive 6 hours into the desert to meet with Agabeh's boss, Colonel Fatah. In a country where the president was a colonel, being a colonel was big time, remembers Waugh. This was not an inconsequential event, and it took me by surprise. Without further explanation, Waugh was driven to Tobruk, not far from the border with Egypt. There, he was brought to meet with Colonel Fatah. "We notice you are good with the camera," Waugh recalls Colonel Fatah telling him. The comment sent a chill up his spine. Had he been discovered? Did Libyan intelligence know he was working for the CIA? "We'd like you to cross over into Egypt and take photographs of the Egyptian armed forces set up there," Colonel Fatah said. From the tone of the colonel's voice, it sounded like an offer Waugh was not supposed to refuse. His mind worked quickly, thinking through a scenario. He told the colonel that he flat out couldn't do that. "Why not?" the colonel asked. "If the U.S. found out about it, I'd be charged with spying for a foreign country," Waugh said. "Treason." Colonel Fatah told Waugh he didn't see the logic. Waugh tried explaining, but Colonel Fatah wasn't interested. After that, Waugh says, he felt his relationship with the Libyan command structure cool. For a while, he was assigned to a remote military base on the northeast coast, at Darna. Then he was sent back to the facility outside Benghazi. Across the Arab world, things were getting worse for American workers. On base, Waugh mostly wore his balaclava, but a lot of the time it was off. He was tan from the intense sunshine, but everyone knew he was the American with sandy blonde hair. In November, a group of students stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and took more than 60 American hostages. Hostilities toward Americans escalated from there. On December 2nd, Waugh received a call from Mohammed Al-Faraj bin Agabeh. "Something was happening," Agabeh said. "Gaddafi was furious with the Americans, and Waugh needed to leave the country immediately or he'd be arrested." In Saudi Arabia, local Sunni terrorists had seized the Grand Mosque in Mecca. They'd taken hundreds of worshippers hostage and laid siege to Islam's holiest site. As fierce gun battles raged inside the mosque, Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini took advantage of the chaos and unleashed a black propaganda campaign against Israel and America. "The real culprits behind the mosque siege," Khomeini declared, "were the Zionists and the great Satanists of the United States." The siege was in fact led by a group of Islamic fundamentalists called Al-Ikhwan, the Brethren, but Iran's supreme leader was pushing a fictional story that Israeli and American commandos had parachuted into the mosque, disguised as Muslims, and committed the attack against Islam. Khomeini had encouraged revolutionaries to go out and attack U.S. embassies in the Middle East and Africa as a response. His followers obeyed, and the U.S. embassy in Tripoli was now under siege. Waugh caught a taxi and headed to the airport, leaving everything behind, including the clothes in his hotel room and the money in its safe. On a television in the airport, state TV showed footage of a violent mob outside the U.S. embassy in Tripoli chanting, "Death to America." Demonstrating solidarity with the Iranian Revolution, some 2,000 Libyans had attacked the embassy and set it on fire. 12 Americans were trapped inside, locked in a walk-in vault. Waugh caught a flight to Frankfurt. By the time he landed, the embassy siege was over, and American officials were saying that everyone had escaped without harm. It would be 32 years before Waugh returned to Libya for the CIA in October 2011, in the days immediately before Gaddafi was killed and disfigured by a violent mob. In December 1979, U.S. dealings with Gaddafi were far from over. On the 29th, the U.S. State Department created its first official State Sponsors of Terrorism list, with four countries, including Iran and Libya. Gaddafi responded with one of the most bizarre international assassination campaigns in modern history. He publicly announced a state-sponsored targeted killing program, which he officially called Physical Liquidation of the Stray Dogs. Gaddafi said that his targeted killing program extended to any Libyan dissident who spoke out against his government. In a fiery speech broadcast on state radio, he called for the physical liquidation of the enemies of the revolution abroad. While it sounded like bluster, it was not. Over the next several months, four anti-Gaddafi Libyan emigres were assassinated: Mohammed Mustafa Ramadan and Mahmoud Abu Salim Nafa in London, and Abdul Arif Galil and Mohammed Salim Ratimi in Rome. Come spring, the U.S. State Department ordered the expulsion of four Libyan diplomats in Washington, whom President Carter described as would-be assassins. On May 1, 1980, the Financial Times reported that police departments in the United States, Britain, France, Italy, and West Germany had been alerted by Interpol to guard against a possible wave of assassinations by Gaddafi's hit teams. Gaddafi issued a final warning to anti-government Libyan exiles living abroad. "This is their last hope," he said. "Either they return to Libya, where they would be safe and sound, or they will be liquidated wherever they are." When a Libyan emigre living in Fort Collins, Colorado, ignored Gaddafi's threats, Gaddafi sent one of his assassins to Colorado. The assassin was a former Green Beret named Eugene Tafoya. It was 7:30 on the night of October 14, 1980, and a Fort Collins police officer named Ray Martinez answered a call on his radio. There was a woman named Farida Zaghali on the other end. She was hysterical. Her husband, Faisal, had been shot in the head and was lying on the floor of their apartment in a pool of blood, she cried. Officer Martinez needed to come over to 1917 South Shields Street right away. Officer Martinez recognized the name. 6 months earlier, Faisal Zaghali, a Libyan graduate student, had applied for and received a permit to carry a concealed weapon, a 9mm semi-automatic pistol. Zaghali's reason for needing the weapon was unheard of, certainly for a city like Fort Collins. He claimed to be on a hit list of people Colonel Muammar Gaddafi of Libya intended to assassinate as part of his Physical Liquidation of the Stray Dogs campaign. Back then, it sounded downright fictional. Officer Martinez hurried over to the apartment and rushed inside. There, on the floor, he found Faisal Zaghali lying in a pool of blood, two bullets in his head. The first 22 caliber bullet entered the eye socket, severed the optic nerve, and lodged in Faisal Zaghali's mouth. The second bullet sheared off part of his ear before entering his head through the cheek. The furniture in the living room was knocked over. Clearly, there had been a struggle. There was blood everywhere on the carpet and the walls. There were bloody handprints on the doorframe. The assassin, it seemed, had vanished. Officer Martinez interviewed two witnesses from the apartment building. One helped a sketch artist draw a composite of the suspect. The second witness described a man with a pockmarked face and a clip-on necktie who was carrying a silver and blue handgun. Detectives drove to the Denver airport and circulated the suspect sketch. A shuttle bus driver said he recognized the man and gave the FBI a few more clues. After a few days, there was a remarkable lead. The FBI received news of an English-language broadcast from a Libyan revolutionary group that was taking credit for what it called a physical liquidation. This was part of the final stage in the revolutionary conflict between Libya and the imperialist United States, the group said. A member of the World Revolutionary Committee has liquidated one Faisal Zaghali. It looked like Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi was behind this assassination attempt, that his reach had extended into the United States. Despite having been shot twice in the head at close range, Zaghali was still alive. He'd been blinded in his right eye, but lived to tell the tale. Farida Zaghali had already told the FBI everything she knew and could remember. The couple had been out of work, she said, when they received an unsolicited phone call from a woman who identified herself as a recruiter for an insurance company looking for people who spoke Arabic. Farida Zaghali said the job interested her. The insurance company arranged to send someone to the house for an interview. It turned out to be the assassin. The man was strange and had alcohol on his breath, Farida Zaghali told the FBI. She went into the kitchen to make drinks, and when she came out, the assassin and her husband were engaged in hand-to-hand combat. "He began striking me in rapid-fire karate blows," Faisal Zaghali told the FBI from his hospital bed. Faisal remembered raising his arms up to protect himself when the assassin reached for his gun. Faisal reached for his own gun, which he said he kept hidden under the couch cushions. The assassin's gun went off. "I felt I was shot in my head, and I felt blood, but I kept struggling with him so I could take his gun," Zaghali testified. "We struggled from one end of the apartment to the other." The FBI took over, but the case went cold. Then, as circumstance would have it, months later, two local boys on bicycles happened upon a .22-caliber blue and silver handgun lying in a ditch along a country road. The FBI traced the weapon to a retired dog warden living in a trailer park in the Florida Keys. The man, named Tully Strong, said he'd sold the gun to an old friend from Vietnam named Eugene Tafoya, a former Green Beret who'd been decorated with the Bronze Star for heroism. The FBI learned Tafoya lived in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. With a bomb squad at the ready, they secured the perimeter, and in a ruse to lure Tafoya from the home without a struggle, they cut the power to his house. When Tafoya came out, they arrested him. Inside, the FBI located a trove of incriminating evidence: drawings of the Zaghali's apartment complex, a stack of Libyan currency, and a tape recording of a phone conversation from someone offering to pay Tafoya to take care of someone who should quit breathing permanently. The FBI arrested Eugene Tafoya. Tafoya said the man to blame was Edwin P. Wilson, an American CIA agent living in a seaside villa in Tripoli, Libya. Tafoya said his intention was to rough up Faisal Zaghali, not kill him. Tafoya told the FBI he believed he was working for the CIA. After a sensational jury trial, Eugene Tafoya was convicted of third-degree assault and conspiracy to commit third-degree assault, but was acquitted on the more serious charges of attempted first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. The jurors' verdict indicated that they believed that Tafoya was in fact acting on someone else's behalf, despite the fact that no evidence about the third party was introduced during the trial. "Obviously, we felt there was another party," the jury foreman, Gary Thornburg, told the New York Times. "But it didn't matter for our purposes who that third party was." Eugene Tafoya was sentenced to 2 years in prison. Depending on whom you ask, the FBI and the CIA had been building a case against Edwin P. Wilson for years. In 1982, Wilson was arrested, tried, and convicted of illegally selling weapons to Libya. This included 42,000 pounds of military-grade C4 explosives, which rivaled the U.S. military's domestic stockpile at the time. Wilson had them manufactured in Southern California. Edwin Wilson was sentenced to 52 years in federal prison. He served 22 years, much of it in solitary confinement. Then, in 2004, in a bizarre twist, a Texas judge overturned Wilson's conviction and he was set free. His lawyers had gathered enough evidence to demonstrate to a judge that he'd been informally working for the CIA at the time of his arrest. The lawyers produced 80 instances of contact between Wilson and the CIA. In a legal briefing, Judge Lynn Hughes wrote that the U.S. government had deliberately deceived the court about Edwin Wilson's continuing contacts with CIA officials, thereby double-crossing a part-time informal government agent. Decades later, it came to light that Wilson had initially gone to Libya on behalf of the CIA in 1976 to locate Carlos the Jackal. He'd gone rogue, eventually working for the CIA, but also for Gaddafi. This was after Libya had been placed on the state sponsors of terrorism list. They framed a guilty man, said journalist David Korn. The Eugene Tafoya trial gave Green Berets a bad name. Reports of other special forces operators working as assassins for Muammar Gaddafi were published in newspapers around the country. No one else was ever charged. Billy Waugh knew that his classified work for the CIA against Muammar Gaddafi and military targets in Libya was to remain hidden. It was best for him to lay low. He was given an assignment on the other side of the world, 7,000 miles from Washington, D.C., on an atoll in the middle of the Pacific Ocean called Kwajalein. His cover was as chief of security at the U.S. Kwajalein missile range. In the Marshall Islands, the Defense Department was testing a highly classified missile system outfitted with a 10-nuclear warhead payload called a MIRV, Multiple Independently Targetable Reentry Vehicle. The Soviets wanted one. Waugh was tasked with training and overseeing 100 military security officers who were in charge of surveillance of the 25 islands and atolls near and around Kwajalein. The missiles were launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. They were programmed to hit a target 5,000 miles away, sometimes just a buoy on the ocean near Kwajalein. Ever on the prowl, Soviet submarines would quickly surface the moment the MIRV became visible on reentry, then dispatch a small Zodiac boat loaded with Russian amphibious special forces called Spetsnaz Delfin. If the Russians were to capture a piece of a missile or a MIRV, it would be a counterintelligence coup d'etat. Day in and day out, floating on the open sea in his own Zodiac, Billy Waugh scanned the horizon for a sign of Soviet infiltration. When he spotted one of their Zodiacs, he'd charge toward it, ready to grab a Soviet operator and bring him in for interrogation. "I never got a Russian, but the Russians never got a MIRV," says Waugh.